forum for frank talk about what people do for a living. Works do.
Hello, and welcome to Works Do. It's June 20th, 2013, and this is episode number 67. I'm Kate Gase Walton. I'm the editor of Works Do, an online collection of essays and interviews in which people ponder their work lives. In this episode, I speak with the soundtracker, Gordon Hempton. He's made a life and a living out of listening. I'm talking this evening with Gordon Hempton, who is an acoustic ecologist. I want to get into, in a moment, what that really means and the work that you've been doing most recently. But let's first go back in time and tell me, when was the first time you went into nature and recorded sound? And what was it that motivated you to do that?
Oh, that's a really good question, because actually the first time that I recorded sound was not in nature. I actually, just to back up even further, found out that I wasn't a listener at all, and this rather shocked me. I stumbled upon that by accident, but I decided that using a microphone and a tape recorder at the time was the best way for me to begin to listen to the world, as if I had had a face mask suddenly handed to me and I could look at the coral reef. So my coral reef was downtown Seattle, recording at Second and Cherry, Baby-O's, punk rockers hanging out. They thought it was really cool that this young kid, or actually older adult, 27, I was, and some of them I think were about 18 or 19, hanging out there, that I was recording. So they would take the microphone from me and interview each other, and it was a real lively time. So I expanded from there to record hobos. I hop freight as a hobby, and so it was only natural that I recorded hobos and their love story, their romantic way of life, and their tragic childhoods, and that big contrast. And it was while I was waiting for another train that I began to listen to nature. Those long hours, which there's really nothing to do but simply be. And I started to listen to birdsong, and I asked myself, why does birdsong sound like music? Because it doesn't sing for my benefit. And that began to open up a whole list of questions.
So the sound that you were recording before, the hobo stories, the Seattle music sounds before that, what were you doing with it? Were you actually making a living out of it at that time, or how were you making a living?
Oh, well, I was making a living as a bike messenger. I actually dropped out of graduate school in Wisconsin. I had planned on becoming a plant pathologist. But I dropped out kind of dissatisfied that my paint-by-numbers life really wasn't going to allow me to be my true self. I wasn't planning on being the soundtracker, right? I wasn't planning on being the soundtracker. I was just planning on being a better listener. So as my equipment evolved, and I was faced with, because after all, recording nature sounds, which is what I do best, requires equipment which is more expensive and more refined than what we need for music or voice or anything like that. So I was faced as a bike messenger with this big hurdle. Was I going to spend $15,000 to buy a Nagra tape recorder and an expensive German microphone system called Fritz that replicates human hearing? And if I was, well, this is a professional decision. And so with that decision and only making a dollar per delivery as a bike messenger, I became the soundtracker. But it was another, I guess it was 6 years beyond that decision until I would be able to get off a bicycle and become full-time soundtracker. And that happened in one fell swoop with a grant from the Charles A. Lindbergh Fund.
And so talk a little bit about what it's meant to be the soundtracker. What is that actually involved? I understand you've gone around the world three times.
Well, to be the soundtracker, I tell you, I really identify with that. I am the soundtracker more than I am Gordon Hempton. Gordon Hempton is a name that was given to me. Okay, soundtracker is who I am and who I feel. What I love about soundtracking is that even though I have a bunch of excuses that get me to a location, I know that I have to let go of what it is that I think a place will be saying, will be expressing to me, if I'm really going to listen. Because one of the biggest problems I've found in trying to become a better listener is that there are all kinds of things I wish people were saying. There are all kinds of things that I want the world to be like, and it simply isn't. And what happens when you want certain things is you just listen for them rather than listen to everything. So I learned through a microphone, because a microphone doesn't have a brain. It listens to the world and all sounds with equal importance. And isn't it magic when you hold a microphone in your hand that all of a sudden you do too?
You talk about getting out there and trying to release that expectation of what you want to hear and instead listening to what's there. And yet, I suppose there have at times been expectations. I was reading in one interview that there was a time you said, once I just downright wept my guts out because the sound I came to hear doesn't exist anymore. And that's been a part of your experience of going out wanting to hear something, wanting to listen to something, and it's not there. Can you talk about that moment and that that occurrence more generally?
Yes. Well, since I've been doing this for 30 years and the world is so rapidly erupting with noise pollution, the places that I recorded in the 80s, almost all of them were in Washington State. At that time, there were 21 places in Washington State where you could simply listen to the sounds of nature without noise pollution for 15 minutes at a time. And today, there are only three. They're only protected by their anonymity, so I'm not going to tell you where they are, except the one that I'm trying to save in particular, kind of the test to see if we can actually save quiet places, and that's Olympic National Park. There's one place in particular that was dear to my heart, and, well, a couple of places, actually a long list of places that have vanished now. I'll talk about the place in Washington State first. It's an isolated lake, a lake that produced the Evening Hatch, a beautiful series of sound portraits where the trout rise to the surface of the lake and the delicate whine of mosquito wings and songbirds around the perimeter, in a two-hour-long recording of which we start with the last ripples as the wind dies down and the last laps along the lake edge. We go through the trout feeding and end with the distant calls of those isolated frogs as the temperatures drop and one by one and you're left to the quiet. But no more. Because 8 miles away, there was a highway improvement program, and they expanded the road, removed the vegetation, and so the sound propagation or the highway noise propagation is much more accessible to that small little amphitheater. And when things quiet down, instead of hearing the stillness of the night, you hear the distant traffic. There's another place, too. Far away in Arkansas, I was lured in by the frogs. They were just magic that night, the way that they were calling, and plus with the bayou, which it was, and the cypress trees, the way they create this beautiful amphitheater. It's not just the frog, but it's the way the frogs define the space. And there's an eeriness with it, but there's also kind of a great childish curiosity because it echoes around almost like it's a mirage. And then the insects would fly by, even the solitary flight of a mosquito, and somehow escaping those drops, first drops of rain that were falling from the sky. And the whole night began and the curtain fell and it became dark. And I recorded all night long until the morning when only the bullfrogs were left with their jug-a-rum, jug-a-rum, and then the first calls of the distant birds, and you could hear the earth spinning. Right? That wave of sunlight that was traveling this way and would wake up the whole other half of the day, right? Those moments are transformative. You begin to look and feel towards the earth entirely differently. I've gone back two times since that time in 1990 that I was first there. The second time, I couldn't make a recording because the agriculture nearby had been changed to oats, and for some darn reason, the oats were getting sprayed by planes, right? It was an aerial application of either herbicide or pesticide. And then I waited. My next opportunity was 5 years later, got back to the bayou, and it had all been divided up into little plots for 5 acres and independence, and the homes were made out of metal, and they clinged and changed with the change of temperature. And the whole sound of the bayou had changed.
So one thing that these experiences have caused in you is, from what I've read, you've become an activist. You're on a charge to save silence. And so why does saving silence matter? Some of the cynics will say, you know, development, it's like language. It's just constantly evolving, and we just have to accept whatever the current form is. Why is preserving some of these soundscapes so important?
And, you know, I find that an amazing question every time it's asked me, and it's practically asked me in every interview. And whenever it's asked, my immediate response is, asking the question just shows the importance of silence, because we have drifted so far away from basic values and standards in the environment that now that is a relevant question. Would it be relevant for us today to ask ourselves, what is the importance of clean water? What is the importance of being able to go swimming in water that's not toxic? Because noise is toxic. There's over 5,000 medical research articles about it at levels far below what take your hearing, okay? And most of our hospitals are twice the level of the safe levels that the World Health Organization has established. Our acoustic world is toxic. So what is the value of the antidote to the toxin if we lose our quiet places, places where we can simply be silent in nature and listen to those sounds that come from miles and miles away? We're going to lose a sense of who we are and where we come from. And we're going to like only have conversations among ourselves about things that have no real relevance to what it's about to be existing. I'll tell you what happens to me when I go to a quiet place, like the Ho Valley, one square inch of silence that I'm trying to save. And if I am successful at saving it, by the way, it'll become the first place on planet Earth to be protected from noise pollution. Can you imagine that? We don't have one place on planet Earth off limits to noise pollution. We do to light pollution, but not to noise. What happens to me is that, you know, I work in front of a computer, I drive a car, I fly, I live a modern life. And you know what happens to my to-do list? It winds up getting, well, right now my to-do list is about 6 pages long, single line items of all the stuff that is important for me to do. And so as soon as it goes over 6 pages, I know I'm long overdue to go to a quiet place and simply be in nature. Because when I get back, yeah, there'll still be the 6 pages, but the only 3 things that are important to do, right? Call my daughter, Abby. Call my son, Gordon, right? Just simply be available to the community, my neighbors. Because silence, in the silence, you know what really counts. You do.
That wraps up the interview for today. Thanks again very much to my guest, Gordon Hempton. Thanks also to everyone who's written an essay for Work Stew. And finally, thanks very much to you for listening today. The next episode will be released in 2 weeks, and I hope you'll check it out. In the meantime, please let me know what you thought of the interview by sending an email to kate@workstew.com, by posting a comment on the Work Stew website, or by writing a review for iTunes. Thanks again, and bye for now.